All right, brothers and sisters, we are now ready to begin our first class. Our first speaker this morning is Brother Mark O'Grady. The theme for his class is this week is Caleb, Giant of Faith. Today's class is entitled He Wholly Followed Yahweh. Brother Mark.
Thank you, Brother Nathan, and good morning, brothers and sisters. Well, we've got the opportunity this week to look at an outstanding example of faith in this man, Caleb. You know, he only has a very brief mention in history, but he left an enduring legacy of faith. We're going to find this morning he's a man of mixed and uncertain origins, but he became a giant in Israel. Now, we know of Caleb as one of only two men from an entire generation who made it into the Promised Land. Now, brothers and sisters, I find that mind-blowing to think about. Only two men of an entire generation. In Numbers chapter 13 and 14, they stand out in their infamy because they're the point where almost an entire generation, having been rescued from slavery in Egypt, was condemned to wander for another 38 years while their carcasses were wasted in the wilderness. The Apostle Paul has some very sobering words for us, doesn't he? We won't turn it up, but 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the Apostle writes, "These things happened to them for examples, and they're written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." But the wonderful thing about this subject is that Caleb shows us what it is that God is looking for those who do inherit the promises. And in turn, he became an inspiration for a new generation who did inherit the Promised Land. So he becomes this bridge between a generation of failure and a generation of success. So in his life are identified the principles by which God brings his people through into the Promised Land. Now we find that Caleb played quite a pivotal role in occasions of national crisis or national significance. But the amazing thing is he wasn't one of the genetic leaders, one of the 12 heads of the tribes. And not only that, we find that he features very prominently in the remarkable incidents of chapter 13 and 14 of Numbers that we're going to look at over the next few days. But then he almost disappears completely from the record, and he suddenly pops up again into the record 45 years later. So what was he doing for all those fateful years in between? And here's a man who, when there was a need, rose to the occasion. So he's quite a remarkable example of someone who sits there, but stands up and leads by example and by his faithful courage in times of crisis or in times of ecclesial need. So our objective this week in our studies in the mornings is to understand what it is that makes this man so remarkable as far as God is concerned. And how can you take someone with an unusual background and transfer him to become a national hero in Israel? And of course, how's that going to encourage us in our own personal journey of faith towards the Promised Land? With all our variety of backgrounds, how do we become part of this promise to Israel in that journey to the Promised Land? Now, as we mentioned the other night, there's a surprising number of references actually to Caleb in the divine record. We won't go through these in detail because we discussed them briefly just the other night, but we're going to go through some of those references with our studies over the next few days. There are a number of other references to Caleb in the record, but they tend to just be repeats of exactly the same story being recorded again for us. All right, well, let's begin our story, first of all, by examining this phrase that Caleb wholly followed Yahweh. I'd like you to come with me to Numbers chapter 13. Now, we're not going to look in Numbers 13 in any detail this morning because that's going to form the basis of our study tomorrow and chapter 14 the following day. But we know the story well. We know that there were 12 spies selected and they were sent in to have a look at the land. And these collective spies came back and they appeared before Moses and Aaron at the door of the tabernacle in front of all the congregation. And they came back and they said, well, Yes, this land is magnificent, just as God had promised. But the people in the land are strong, and the walls are huge, and the cities are impregnable, and there's giants in the land. And they caused the heart of the people to melt. Now, I'd like you to pick up with me Numbers 13 and verse 30. We have Caleb's instant response. Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it." There's no hesitation. There's just this absolute conviction that God's going to help us and we can just go and do it. No problems at all. So the first question for us is, where did that conviction come from? And you know, brothers and sisters, it's really straightforward. It's quite simple. And it's the key to our personal salvation. He simply believed what God had said. Genesis chapter 12, verse 7, Yahweh appeared to Abram and said, "Unto thy seed I will give this land." And then to Moses in Exodus 3, verse 8, Yahweh said to Moses, "I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of that land unto a good land and large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey." So that's God's promise. And we find that in Numbers 14 and verse 7, if we look at it, this is Caleb together with Joshua, they spake to all the company of the children of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to search it is an exceeding good land." You can see on the screen where those words came from. God had said, "I'll bring you to a good land." It's an exceeding good land, they said. Verse 8, "If Yahweh delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey." And they're repeating the promise that God had made to Moses. In fact, brothers and sisters, we find that for 400 years, God had repeatedly, over and again, spoken explicitly about that land and promised that he would bring them in. He promised them over and over and over again that he would bring them into a land that flowed with milk and honey. It's just that there was a whole generation who didn't believe him. And speaking of that generation, the apostle said in Hebrews 3, verse 19, "So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief." But when we look at Caleb and Joshua's response here, we find that they believed what God had promised. So this week, brothers and sisters, let's just concentrate on the simplicity of that message. Do we believe what God has promised? Do we believe that God has said he is able to bring us into the kingdom? Do we believe that God, through Christ, is able to give us eternal life? And that's the simplicity of the question for you and me. It's actually the issue that defines our life. Do we believe that what God promised, he is able to perform? Now, let's be fair. Israel did face some very real, some very big, and some very daunting challenges. You know, those walls were pretty tall, and there were lots of people in those cities, and there were real giants in the land. And in our lives, we too face many obstacles. It might be the ferocious temptations of our current world. It may be our own insecurities and doubts. It might be perplexity and concern about how we bring up our children. It might be that we feel we've been unfairly treated in ecclesial life. It might be that we have a lack of confidence in God's ability to save me or my family. It may be the swamping of our affection by all of the things of daily life that just seem to choke the truth in our hearts from time to time. It might be grinding financial pressures. It might be employment issues. It may be serious health issues and concerns. Or it may be that we are having to face the reality of our own mortality, perhaps in loved ones, or ultimately, for every one of us, in ourselves. Now, those things, brothers and sisters, are big. they are daunting. Sometimes life feels like the way the land was described by those spies. This is a land that eats up its inhabitants. Does life ever feel like that for you? That this life can eat up its inhabitants? So these are big walls. They're big, daunting gates. They are giants and strong enemies. And it seems at times in life as if we're surrounded by all sorts of giants. But the point of this story, brothers and sisters, is that if we actually truly believe that God is able, He will deliver us from every one of those trials. And ultimately, in the end, we will inherit the promised land. And that's the power that sits underneath the story of Caleb. But doesn't that sound oversimplified? Doesn't that sound so trite, so simplistic? You know, it can almost seem offensive. I mean, how can you belittle and minimize the obstacles that I personally face? But it's actually true. All obstacles can be overcome by our God. He gives us strength to cope with what we face, and ultimately will give His people an inheritance in the promised land. Or is it that somehow we feel that actually the obstacles I personally face are actually too big for God to be able to fix? Sure, He was okay for overcoming giants, and He could break down walls, and He could give Israel their inheritance, but you have no idea how big the problems are that I face. They're so unique. But actually, brothers and sisters, the point of this story is it tells us that God is able. That's the power of Caleb's example. Because just think of it like this. You know, Caleb and Joshua, they saw exactly the same sights as all the other spies did. They saw the same walls. They saw the same cities. They saw the same inhabitants all through the land. And they saw the same giants. But they believed what God had said. And this meant that they weren't daunted by the obstacles, because they saw that with God's help, He would help them to overcome. Their God was bigger and stronger and mightier than any foe they would face. And so, brothers and sisters, that's the question for us in our own personal lives. And 45 years later, 45 years he waited, 45 years later, an aged man, still resolute with all that faithful vigor, he proved the enduring validity of faith, because he finally overcame those giants and inherited the promise. Now, last night, and let's have a quick look at it, Numbers 14, verse 24, we looked briefly at that insight that we're given as to what it was that made Caleb so special. Numbers 14, verse 24, "But my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him and hath followed me fully, him will I bring into the land whereinto he went, and his seed shall possess it." So God's statement is that he had another spirit. Jerusalem Bible says, "But my servant Caleb is of another spirit." So this man stood out, brothers and sisters, because he had a different spirit, a different attitude of mind to the others who surrounded him in those days. They didn't believe or trust in their God. And at the very same time that all his peers were joining together to complain about how hard life was and what God had left them and all this mess, Caleb was resolute and confident because he believed in his God, and he was prepared to stand up for those beliefs. In fact, as we're going to see in our next study, his conviction was so strong, it almost cost him his life. He risked everything personally to try and persuade his brethren that they too could trust in God. He tried to calm their fears. He tried to reassure them of God's ability to save, because he not only believed that God would give him the promises, but he believed that God could save his brethren. And his passionate desire was to support his brethren, to encourage them to put their trust in God. And they were so incensed by being shown up by him that they tried to stone him to death. He had that level of conviction. He was prepared to put his life on the line. And so the question for us, brothers and sisters, young people, is do we have that sort of spirit within us? Would we stand up for the things of God if the pressure of those around us was against what God says? In ecclesial life, do we speak up about our confidence that God's able to save? Is our influence on our brothers and sisters around us and on the families in our ecclesia, is our personal influence a reassurance that God is able to save? He will bring us through these trials. He will bring the ultimate inheritance. Does our personal conviction enable us to stand faithfully in times of challenge or opposition? Or what about at work? Do our work colleagues say, "Oh, that person's got a different spirit. There's something different about them, with their belief in God, and the way they're happy to talk about their faith and their conviction that in Jesus Christ we have salvation and life, when it really counts." Would people say that we have a different spirit? Reminds us a little, doesn't it, of the words of our Lord in Matthew 10, verse 32, "Whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven. But whosoever shall deny me before men, him will I also deny before my Father which is in heaven." So Caleb had a different spirit, and then in the verse we're also told what that actually involved. So in the verse it says he has another spirit, "and hath followed me fully." Now that's an extraordinary assessment by God. He looks at Caleb, and he said, "That man has wholly followed me." It means that Caleb set his sights on where God was going, and he determined to follow him with his heart, soul, and mind. You know, it doesn't say here, it's quite impressive, Caleb sometimes followed God. It doesn't say, you know, more than half his life he followed God. It doesn't say from time to time he had a little outburst of faith and followed God. It says he wholly followed Yahweh. And that's a really big thing for us to assess ourselves against, brothers and sisters. He wholly followed Yahweh. Remember again the words of our Lord. The first and greatest of the commandments is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with," and note the words in italics, "all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength." This is the first commandment. Just note that word "all." Now, it doesn't mean, of course, that we neglect our families, or we neglect ecclesial life, or that we neglect our responsibilities in daily life, at work or wherever, but it means we do all of them in the context of a life which is all about the things of God. So we go about our daily activities in a way that has us following God. And it's really a question, isn't it, of our priorities. What do we spend our time with? What's important to us? And what's the spirit that prevails in our own hearts and minds when it comes to following God in our daily lives? Now, you know, that little phrase there in Numbers 14, verse 24, "he wholly followed Yahweh," it's not a throwaway or random phrase. It actually is the consistent hallmark of Caleb's character. It's the reason why he was one of only two of that generation that entered into the promised land. And so it becomes a theme in the record that's associated personally with Caleb. You know, that attribute, "wholly followed Yahweh," there in Numbers 14, it's an attribute given to him by God. But it's also a phrase that's associated with him by Moses. It's a statement that Caleb makes of himself, remarkably. And later in the record, we find that Joshua and all the elders also acknowledge that that's a characteristic of Caleb, because that phrase comes up seven times in Scripture in relation to Caleb. Now, six of them directly relate to him. The seventh, one of them, is in contrast that Israel did not wholly follow Yahweh, whereas Caleb did wholly follow Yahweh. Now, we're not going to go through all of those at the moment. We will come across several of them as we go through, but it's actually worth going through and highlighting and colouring those in. On seven occasions, this phrase, "wholly followed Yahweh," comes up in relation to Caleb and his example to Israel. Now, these remarkable characteristics are all the more extraordinary when we consider who Caleb was and his origins. And as we start to examine Caleb's background, we begin to appreciate the power of his example for us personally. So, who was Caleb? You know, that's a really simple question to ask, but unfortunately, it's not quite so simple to answer. Let's pick up some of the threads of our story. First of all, we find in Numbers 13, when the spies were selected, we find that Caleb comes into the record. So in Numbers 13 and verse 2, God said, "Search me out, or send thou men, that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel. Of every tribe of their fathers shall ye send a man, every one a ruler among them." And that word is Nasi, N-A-S-I-Y, or prince. And the first on the list there, or once, so not the first on the list, but we have in the list there Caleb as part of that record. Verse 6, we're told they selected of the tribe of Judah Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. So Caleb's a prince. Then in verse 2 it says, in verse 3, Moses, by the commandment of Yahweh, sent them from the wilderness of Paran. All those men were heads of the children of Israel. And that's the Hebrew word that we're familiar with, the word Rosh. So Caleb was a prince and a head of the tribe of Judah. We won't turn it up, but actually in Numbers chapter 34 and verse 16, Yahweh appointed a special committee, the Inheritance Allocation Council. This was a committee who had a task, and their task was to actually manage the apportionment of the land as they went in to settle it. So it oversaw the allocation of the inheritance. The team was headed up by Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun. But then in verse 18 of that chapter, Numbers 34, God instructed them to take of every tribe a prince, one prince of every tribe, to divide the inheritance to the children of Israel. And God then nominated 10 men to form that council. Now just think about the logic here. Why 10? Well, 2.5 tribes have already received their inheritance on the other side. So now we have 9.5, or 10 tribes, waiting to receive their inheritance on the western side. And so 10 men were appointed to join together with Joshua and Eleazar to divide up the land. And of course, the very first man of the 10, the very first man listed, is Caleb in verse 19. Of the tribe of Caleb, of Judah, Caleb the son of Jephunneh. Then later, when we go to Joshua chapter 14, we're told that Judah, that all the soldiers of Judah come up and they appear before before Joshua, and Caleb speaks on their behalf. So he's the spokesman on behalf of the tribe of Judah. So we're introduced to Caleb in several places as being a head, a prince, a spokesman on behalf of the tribe of Judah. But he was not, however, the genealogical head or prince of the tribe of Judah. In Numbers 2 verse 3, we read that that role was held by a man called Nahshon, the son of Amminadab. But he's still clearly chosen on a number of occasions to be the leader or the representative of the tribe of Judah. And then we run into a challenge, because as you traverse all the various genealogies of Judah, we can't find Caleb clearly linked by descent into the direct lineage of Judah. In fact, if we peruse in the record in Numbers and in Chronicles, and we go through all of the genealogies, it's actually really hard to pin exactly where Caleb appears. Certainly his name is there. His name is associated with the genealogies of Judah, but he almost appears like an orphan because you can't quite plug him in to a root or a branch of the tribes of Judah. Just come with me to 1 Chronicles chapter 4 to see what I mean by this. 1 Chronicles and chapter 4. And here we have a genealogy of the tribe of the sons of Judah. So verse 1, the sons of Judah, Phares, Hezron, etc. And then we go across to verse 15, and this is where our man Caleb appears. The sons of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, Eru, Elah, and Naam, and the sons of Elah, even Kenaz. But you notice there's no link there with the origins of Jephunneh. There's no way you can trace Jephunneh back into the genealogies of Judah. And then in the very next verse, the record seems to abandon the family of Caleb again. It goes on to talk about the sons of Jehaleleel. In fact, it gets more complicated even than that, because we won't go through it in detail, but if we look at 1 Chronicles chapter 2, there's another more detailed genealogy there. And there we find that in verses 9 and 18, there's a Caleb, the son of Hezron. In verse 42, there's a Caleb, the brother of Jeremiel. In verse 50, there's a Caleb, the son of Hur. It actually appears there's more than one Caleb in the record. And as you go through those names and the list of descendants in each of those occurrences, they don't match the descendants of our Caleb that we looked at in chapter 4. Some suggest that, well, perhaps he's one of those Calebs and he was adopted as an adopted son of Hezron. And it gets hard to actually pin down exactly where he appears in the record, and I don't believe that's accidental. He's clearly linked with the tribe of Judah. I mean, that's inescapable. That's an unavoidable conclusion when you look at his role. He's clearly linked with Judah. But you can't plug him directly and with absolute confidence into the narrative. So because of that, some of the commentators say, well, he's descended from Judah, but we're not sure exactly where. Others say, well, perhaps he was adopted by Hezron or adopted into the family of Judah. Others say, well, really, this just puts emphasis on the fact that Caleb was a Gentile. And you say, aha, well, that's a question we need to tackle. Was Caleb actually a Gentile? Now, I have to admit, I came to the study rather skeptical when I first started looking at Caleb. I just had a bias. I was slightly skeptical of the claim that Caleb was a Gentile. I mean, how could someone be so prominent in the tribe of Judah and not actually be related to the tribe of Judah? It just didn't seem right. But as I started looking through the record, I actually ended up changing my mind and came to the conclusion that when people say Caleb was a Gentile, but they think actually what? So let's have a look at one. Well, first of all, we've got the meaning of his name. Caleb. The word Caleb literally means a dog. It comes from the Hebrew word Eliab, which is the word for dog, all through the Old Testament. So after the talk about dogs eating the body of Jezebel or the lion, am I a dog? You come out sinning its fate. Is this for Caleb? So you may hear the suggestion that because Caleb ate the dog, that proves that Caleb was a Gentile. Well, it is true that in the New Testament, the concept of Gentile is distinct in relation to Israel with dogs. Matthew 15, verse 27, dogs runs at Paul from the master's table. But in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 2, Judaizers are also described as dogs. And furthermore, in those genealogies we looked at before, there are other Calebs. We are literal members of Judah's own tribe, who are also called Caleb. So I don't think we can rely on the meaning of his name as a dog as being the fruit that he's actually a Gentile. All right, well, let's look a little further. We find that Calebs are almost always introduced to us as Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. There's one occasion I could find where he wasn't, and that's in Judges, where the records actually talk more about Ophrah's relation to Caleb. But in every other occurrence, the name Caleb is linked as the son of Jephunneh. Now, in three of those occurrences, we're told a little bit more about Jephunneh. Numbers 32, verse 12, said Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun. They wholly followed Yahweh. Or Joshua 14, verse 6. Then the children of Judah came to Joshua and Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, spoke of. Or Joshua 14, verse 14 again. Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite. Now that's intriguing because the Kenizzites were a Gentile nation. And at that point, it becomes rather more convincing. But the thing I find most convincing is actually Joshua. What could come from Joshua chapter 3 and just describe and just see how the description gives given of the allocation of family to tribe of Judah. Joshua chapter 3. Pick up the record first of all in verse 1. This then was the lot of the tribe of the children of Judah by their families. And then as it goes through the succeeding verses, it tells us the allocation of the land to the tribe of Judah. The intriguing statement is in verse 3. Unto Caleb the son of Jephunneh, he gave a part among the children of Judah according to the commandment of Yahweh, speaking from Joshua. Now, to my mind, that's quite compelling. If Caleb was of the tribe of Judah by birth, why would the record state that Caleb was given an inheritance amongst the tribe of Judah? I mean, it would be actually, man, it's obvious that this part of Judah would be given an inheritance amongst the tribe of Judah. And I believe that point of reference is actually noting something that's worth our attention, that here's this man who's the senior in advice, and he is given an inheritance amongst the tribe of Judah. That's quite lovely that he is a Gentile. So I believe, brother and sister, this is a Gentile. He's a man of non-Israelite origins, and yet he is a man who's given the covenants and promise. And at some point, his family forefathers have embraced the hope of Israel. And God was pleased to accept this man of his faithful inheritance, his faithful commitment to what God then promised to the past. So what does that tell us, brother and sister? It tells us that it's possible for Gentiles to come and be embraced
embraced in the covenants of Pops. In fact, it is possible for a Gentile to come in and become a leader of the tribe of Judah. And that tells us to never give up hope, to never feel that we're not part of the promises of Israel, but to understand that in God's ways, He's provided an opportunity for Gentiles and actually become part of the promises to Abraham, to become part of his people with the hope of Israel. God is no respecter of person. Remember the words of our Lord, of these stones God can raise up children through Abraham. So we've looked and we find that by descent, Caleb is not like Israelite natural. And isn't that so off the way in Scripture? It's actually telling us it doesn't matter what family we are born into. It's whether we believe, and it's how we behave that defines whether we have access to God's wonderful promise. And we find in the divine record that so often it's faith, it's not the strength or the natural inheritance of the flesh, which provides so much. To find that it is eating of barren women. You find that there are 15 of the firstborn sons who didn't inherit the blessing. He lost the birthright. We find that mistake. God has chosen the weak things of the world, death and mice. And I believe that's where the name, the meaning, and its name comes from. Because the idea of a dog is something your kids might be understanding. I think that could mark the line. Am I a dog? That you come to me with sticks? And so a dog is something that's might be established. Here's a man of Gentile origin. This man, highly esteemed by God, because he believes in God's promise. All right, well, let's examine one of these few leads that we're actually getting. When we're told that he was the son of Phanah, who is a Kenizzite. Now, that then gives us two options in terms of Kenizzites as a nationality. It was people. We won't set it up, but first of all, in Genesis chapter 3, we have a list of the nations, Canaanite nations, that were in the land when Abraham was first given the promise. And it lists different nations that were in the land. And the Kenizzites in verses 19 and 20 in that list, Kenizzites are listed one of the nations in the land in the days of. It's spelled a little differently. It has two Z's rather than one. But in the Hebrew, name. So the first question is, well, was Japhonah? I believe that's unlikely. And with some of these things, we can't be absolutely dogmatic. We can just simply look at the evidence and work out what we believe it is. I believe that's unlikely because those earlier Kenizzites disappear completely from the record after that point. So there are many occasions where the Canaanite nations are listed. So, for example, in Deuteronomy 7, verse 1, it lists the seven nations that were cast out who were greater and mightier than thou. And the Kenizzites don't appear in any of those subsequent lists. So I don't think it's that family of Kenizzites. Well, the second option, which I think fits in with the biblical themes better, is to look at Esau's family. Because the Kenizzites are referred to as one of the branches of Esau's family, part of the Edomites. And they're described, of course, in Deuteronomy 23, verse 7, as being Israel's brother. So why do we say the Kenizzite is descended from Edom? Well, the phrase Kenizzite, it's a patronym, which means it's of Kenaz. So this is Caleb, the son of Japhonah, who is descended from Kenaz. He is a Kenizzite. And in the genealogies of Esau, found in Genesis 36, and again in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, one of the grandsons of Esau, the son of his firstborn Eliphaz, his grandson was called by the name of Kenaz. Now, this Kenaz became an important leader, an important man in Esau's clans. He's known in the record as Duke Kenaz. And as we're going to see, it would be very fitting for Caleb to be descended from Duke Kenaz. Why is that? Well, in your mind, I'd like you to cast back and think about the history and the story of Jacob and Esau. What was the great conflict between Esau and Jacob? What did they argue about? The inheritance, the blessings, the promises. Esau wanted his inheritance. He felt it was his right. He felt it had been deceitfully stolen from him by Jacob on two different occasions. And he wanted to murder his brother because of it. Another notable feature of Esau's descendants was they had this remarkable obsession with the here and now. I want my inheritance, and I want it now. In 1 Chronicles 1, they're described as being dukes, they're described as being kings, they're described as having cities,
And the chapter finishes with a resolution, a ringing declaration. These are the dukes of Edom. I'd like you to come with me to Genesis 36, and we'll find that there we have the genealogies of Esau, and we'll find the same emphasis of the record. Genesis 36. Verse 1, these are the generations of Esau. In verse 15, we have the dukes. These were the dukes of the sons of Esau, the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, Duke Teman, Duke Omar, Duke Zepho, Duke Kenaz. There's our man Kenaz. When we go to verse 31, these are the kings that reigned, for they reigned in effect the children of Israel. And if we turn over to verse 43, it finishes off. Duke Magdiel, Duke Iram, these be the dukes of Edom, according to, notice these words, their habitations in the land of their possession. Notice the emphasis, their habitations in the land of their possession. He is Esau, the father of the Edomites. So the overwhelming emphasis on possession, on lands, on kingship, dukes, on cities. Now have a look at chapter 37 and verse 1. And Jacob lived in the land where his father was a stranger. Can you sense the contrast? And then it goes on to say, these are the generations of Jacob. His boys were shepherds. And you can't help but feel the contrast that the divine record is painting between the descendants of Esau with their mighty, their kings and their dukes and their cities and their possessions and their lands and the family of strangers. This is the theme that's divinely noted in Hebrews 11, verse 9. By faith, Abram sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. You know, back in chapter 35, Jacob returns to the promised land. And in verse 21, it says that Israel journeyed and spread his tent beyond the Tower of Edar. He's a sojourner. Then in verse 27 of that chapter, it says that he finally arrives back. He dwells with his father Isaac, and the record's very pointed. It says this is where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. And then again in chapter 37, verse 1, Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger. So the record's making this point that here was a family of sojourners. So what's the spirit of the sojourner? Well, we know from Scripture the sojourner just believes what God's promised. Yes, they're vitally interested in a future inheritance, but they're prepared to wait, waiting for God to deliver the promise in the future. They accept God's timing. They do embrace others. They allow others to come and jointly be part of their community of sojourners together, all of them pilgrims and strangers together. Now, Esau never learnt that spirit. He wanted his inheritance now. You could describe it as the oxymoron of temporary permanence. The oxymoron of temporary permanence. That's what he wanted. He wanted his permanent inheritance, but he was only going to get it temporarily. It took Jacob many decades to learn the right spirit of the sojourner. Now, where did the family sojourn? Does anyone have an answer? What place is particularly linked with the spirit of the sojourner? Any thoughts? Any guesses? Hebron, excellent, Hebron, which of course means fellowship. There's a fellowship here of sojourners. But in Genesis 35, in fact, let's just turn it back. Genesis 35, verse 27, Jacob came to Isaac his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. Now, what else happened in Hebron? Well, you know, there's a cave in Hebron, the cave of Machpelah. And in that cave was a whole bunch of bones of dead people who were buried in faith because they looked for a city to come whose builder and maker was God. That's what Hebron spoke of. Hebron spoke of sojourning, waiting for God's future promises. Note carefully, too, that in Genesis 36, it was actually from Hebron that Esau departed from the family. The record makes the comment in verses 6 to 8 that he took his wives, his sons, his daughters, all the persons of his house, his cattle, his beasts, and all his substance which he'd got in the land of Canaan, and he went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob, for their riches were more than that they might dwell together. The land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. So here's a member of the family who makes the decision to leave the place of fellowship. He moves down to the region of Seir, and he builds himself cities. And you can just see the contrast in the divine record. And then one of those descendants is this Duke Kenaz. But at some point, one of the descendants of Kenaz, Jephunneh, the son of the Kenazite, at some stage, one of their forefathers, made the decision that they would separate from Edom and Esau, and they would stay clinging to the sojourners in the land of Israel. Now, we don't know exactly when in the generations that decision was made. Probably, in all likelihood, they didn't depart with the rest of Esau's family when he left, because we know that they ended up down in Egypt. I mean, after all, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, came with Israel out of Egypt. So here is a member of that family who has made a different choice. Now, that is so out of character for a child of Edom. What would have taken for an Edomite, and bear in mind the family hatred they had for Jacob and his descendants, what would it take for an Edomite to decide that believing in future promises made to Abraham and Isaac, their grandfathers, was actually more important than getting a possession now in the cities of Edom? And what's more, joining together with that other side of the family. And what's more, accepting that the promises given to Abraham and Isaac, who they jointly shared as forefathers, had correctly been decided by God to go through the lineage of Jacob. What would it take for a child of Esau to take that spirit? Only somebody who had believed in God's right to decide where the lineage would go, and who had absolute conviction that what God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was actually the better destiny, and was prepared to leave aside all the connections of this world and join the other side and stay as strangers and pilgrims. In the words of Malachi 1 verse 2, "Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith Yahweh? Yet I loved Jacob, and I hated Esau." And here's a member of Esau's family who accepts that. Wouldn't that take humility, brothers and sisters? So here we have this extraordinary family, and those values endure. They smolder during the long years of oppression and darkness in Egypt. They burst into life again when we come across this character, Caleb. Because despite being a descendant of Duke Kenaz and Esau, he's taken on the values of the sojourners of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he's joined himself to this community so thoroughly, he's become so respected, that when they look for an appropriate leader from the tribe of Judah, it's Caleb who they select. Now, just bear in mind, Caleb was 38 years old when they left Egypt. So he's been brought up by his father in the worst period of Pharaoh's oppression of the children of Israel. So he would have experienced that bitter slavery in the land of Egypt. He left Egypt. He marched with the children of God. He saw the plagues and the miracles that were done. He was there with Israel as they walked through the Red Sea and saw those towering walls of water. This is a man who believed and breathed the spirit of Moses, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. That's Hebrews 11, verse 25. So that's the motivation, brothers and sisters, that persuaded this family to throw in their lot with the children of God. There's this resolute belief in the integrity of God's promises. Now, doesn't that bring out a rather powerful lesson for us, brothers and sisters? To stand aside from everything that this world offers, from all the, well, I guess, from the oxymoron of temporary permanence, because that's what this world is obsessed with. And we make that choice, brothers and sisters, to live as strangers and as pilgrims, because we look for a better city to come. And that those values, they colour the choices that we make in life. And when we make those choices, brothers and sisters, we establish a legacy that can endure. And if we're able to pass on that spirit to our children, then they also inherit the legacy of the promises to Abraham. And here's Jephunneh the Kenizzite, and he has passed that spirit on to Caleb, his son. So at 40, we find Caleb driven by an overwhelming faith that completely outshone natural Israel. And at 85? At 85, he's this outstanding example of resolute faithfulness, still energizing an old man as he finally receives his inheritance. And then we find, actually, that in turn, that influence was passed on to his children and his grandchildren as well. So there's a power in the truth, brothers and sisters. The truth is able to overcome. It is able to sustain. It's able to energize. It's able to help overcome challenges. And those who believe in the promises will ultimately receive them. Now, a quick question. When Caleb finally received the inheritance, after waiting 45 years for it, by the way, when he finally received his inheritance, which portion of the land did he receive? What territory was given to him? Joshua 15, verse 13. Unto Caleb the son of Jephunneh he gave a part among the children of Judah, even the city of Arba, the father of Anak, which city is Hebron. Of all places for that Gentile to be given, he was given the city of Hebron. He received the inheritance of the place of the sojourners. The cave of Machpelah was given to Caleb and his descendants. Isn't that extraordinary? To a Gentile, the cave of Machpelah. So you can see, brothers and sisters, how this story just speaks to us with the power of faith. How through faith, if we believe that God is able, we have the opportunity to inherit those glorious promises. And so, brothers and sisters, we've been introduced to a man that had a different spirit, a man who wholly followed after Yahweh. So let's learn to take on the spirit of the sojourner, the spirit of someone who waits for God in his time to give the promises, but rests on an absolute conviction that what God has promised, he's able to perform.